This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Saturday Magazine, sponsored by Velocity Rewards,
your award-winning loyalty program for Virgin Australia's frequent flyers.
Hey, you. Yeah, you, in the car. Did you know that a big portion of people who listen to Joy in the car, just like you? Right now, times are really tough financially, and without your support, Joy may not be around to make your drive around Melbourne fun. So tell your siblings, your workmates, heck, even wind down your window and tell someone else stuck in the traffic to head over to joy.org.au and help us build Joy Nation by making a donation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
A unique mix of world news and queer culture, Saturday Magazine, every Saturday, 10 till 12, on Joy 94.9.
You are on Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9. Macca and Tass.
Thank you, Macca. Macca, a couple of issues that really impact on our community are, of course, mental health and the arts. And we thought that it was actually time to ask Martin Foley, who happens to be the Minister for not only Equality but also the Arts and Mental Health, to come in and have an extended conversation with us about the impact of these issues on our communities. Good morning to you, Martin Foley.
Good morning, Macca. Good morning, Tess. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Great to have you on the airwaves.
We're very well, Martin, and look, we really appreciate the time.
We're actually really pleased to be out of the house, to be really honest.
Yes.
Even though we're sitting in separate studios looking at each other through glass walls, we can at least wave and get out of the house and have a bit of variety in our lives for a change.
It is. Look, I wanted to start off, Martin. There's been a whole, you know, the government's been doing a whole lot of work in some really important areas and supporting that. But I wanted to ask, you know, look, on a personal level, you know, as a member of parliament and as a minister, you know, in the past you would have spent a huge part of your day out and about meeting people, you know, talking to different groups, having different meetings, you know, face to face. And now, of course, that really doesn't happen very much, and I assume you're also doing a fair bit of work from home. How have you adapted to that change, and how does it feel?
Well, it's been very unusual in many respects, but, what are we, 10 weeks in, 11 weeks in now, and I've managed to master so many different digital meeting platforms that I didn't know they all existed. But having said all that, you know you have to do it. You know that in many respects, if we have to lead by example and get ahead of the coronavirus infection curve, it's by minimising movement around the community, minimising the opportunities for the virus to spread. And you do what you have to do to achieve that. The question is, how do we manage the cost and the impact of that? And it's the one set of issues, and you know, whether it's through the arts and culture lens or the mental health lens or the LGBTIQ equality lens or any number of other approaches, the pandemic has been hugely disruptive. And it's the focus on dealing with the consequences of the pandemic that has certainly kept me and many others busy in the last little while.
So talk to us a bit about some of those consequences, and in particular, in your capacity as Minister for the Arts and Minister for Mental Health, what sorts of themes are emerging? What sorts of issues are emerging?
Under the wider heading of just massive and unexpected disruption, we've seen that play out in many, many ways. Through our mental health services, we've seen a remarkable sort of two-facing ways at the same time set of issues. On the one hand, we've seen frontline services, whether they be digital or phone services, such as Beyond Blue, Lifeline, suicide prevention line, and indeed community-specific groups such as Switchboard and the perinatal support lines and a raft of others, never been busier in terms of low-level but significant mental illness challenges as anxiety, depression, isolation plays out in a greater number than we've ever seen before. Some services report that they're over 50% up on just the month before the pandemic started.
And Martin, what about in the alcohol and drug space? Because that's clearly part of your portfolio as well. What's occurring there?
Well, this is a complicated issue because, of course, in terms of both illicit and illicit drugs, we see changing patterns. Illicit drugs continue to be available, but sadly abused in increasing numbers. And in terms of illicit drugs, particularly opioids, the normal supply lines have dried up very quickly. But sadly, we've seen early signs of, shall we say, entrepreneurs seek to fill that gap with more domestically produced materials. And it's early days, but we are looking towards some pretty nasty stuff out there in the community that isn't very safe at all. Play that through, and it's still a bit early to say, but on the one hand, we've seen increasing reports of people overdosing and using different drugs in isolation, community members that you would not have necessarily thought would be in this space. And at the other end, we've seen reports of alcohol and other illicit drugs sales and use going up. The truth is, these issues don't play out immediately. They take a cumulative effect, and it's that second wave, as people like Professor Patrick McGorry and others have pointed to, in 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, where the cumulative effect of these issues comes to bear. Overlay those against what looks like a looming economic slowdown and job losses and the disruption and trauma that goes with that. This is a very significant time in our ability to get ready for what might well be a nasty in a different way consequence of the pandemic. That will be the mental health wave of trauma and sadly despair that we will see coming in the months and years ahead.
Now, I've noticed that my own alcohol consumption has increased. I mean, I've been somebody who might have had one or two drinks a week. I've now been having, on average, one drink a day. And we've been, you know, loosely calling it cocktail hour. So we'll get onto some sort of device and have a conversation with a friend or a colleague and use that as a way of socialising with a, you know, cocktail of some sort. And Negronis is what I've discovered of late. So, I mean, for us, it's been part of our social connectedness with the rest of the outside world. But do you think it's sort of, is it isolation that's driving people to increase consumption, isolation and perhaps loneliness, or what else is going on?
In many ways, the pandemic has amplified existing trends of particularly alcohol and drug abuse that was out there and overuse. Not to say that patterns of consumption haven't increased, they have, but there's a long way between a cocktail hour once a day or even a couple of times a day to chronic abuse and everything that goes with that, unfortunately.
I can assure you it is once a day in my case.
I'm sure. But it's a spectrum that we deal with. And the existing patterns of isolation, existing patterns of mental illness, we know from history and from global studies, these become amplified and they grow in circumstances of community stress and trauma. And the pandemic has amplified those factors enormously over the last 3 months, and every piece of evidence tells us, including the National Cabinet a week or two ago forecast that with the rising unemployment, the rising use of alcohol and other drugs, both licit and illicit, and the rising consequences of isolation and, with it, sadly, family violence, economic distress, and the isolation that some groups of our community who haven't been considered, sadly, Australian enough in terms of getting support from different levels of government, this distress all comes together in a growing pattern of mental illness and its different expressions.
Now, Martin, we know, you know, we've spoken previously about the, you know, the inquiry in Victoria into mental health.
The Royal Commission.
The Royal Commission and the findings of that and, you know, the commitment that yourself and the Premier and the government has made, you know, to address these issues. So this is, we've already got a serious issue with mental health. We're now piling on more in mental health. And, you know, Tim Pellis, as Treasurer, won't like me asking this question, but how are we going to pay for this? We hadn't worked out previously how we were going to pay for this. We're talking my figure. We're talking, you know, billions of dollars over the next decade. We're now going to be adding to that. So how are we going to, one, resource it? Because, you know, you need professionals to do it. How do you think we're going to find the money? Do you have any innovative ideas?
Well, thanks, Macca. And yes, we do. Well, you will recall that we are well down the path of our Royal Commission into Victoria's mental health system. And the truth is, you don't hold a Royal Commission into a system that is working.
No.
And the amplification of the broken nature of our mental health system that the pandemic and the consequences of it will highlight will just further emphasise the need for reform. We were due to respond to the Royal Commission's interim recommendations in the state budget, which would have been in the first week of May, but is now, as a consequence of the pandemic, being put off till October. And one of the commitments from the Royal Commission, one of its interim recommendations, was to establish a dedicated source of revenue or levy to pay for the growth of the new services and approach, new model of care, that the Commission was in the process of putting together. In the last 3 months, as a result of the pandemic, we have nonetheless continued to fund those found new funds for the rollout of the recommendations, of the interim recommendations, be it support for lived experience, carers, people with mental illness in the community, suicide prevention programs, 175 new acute mental health beds in the communities most at risk now of shortages of services, rollout of support programs in regional Victoria. And that is our packages in the last few weeks of the pandemic have passed about a $60 million worth of new services. But as you say, Macca, that is barely scratching the surface of what we would expect to see from the Royal Commission's final recommendations about how the entire new model of care needs to be developed and co-designed with people with lived experience, because one of the big problems that we have with mental illness in our community is not just the lack of services to those who are acutely unwell and essentially drives a whole set of other factors from homelessness to.
And you are listening to Saturday Magazine with Macca and Tass. We have Martin Folley, who's very well known to our community as the Minister for Equality, the Arts and, of course, Mental Health. Martin, just continuing on from the conversation, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
He's hanging on our every word, Tass.
I am hanging on your every word.
Well, we're keen to take the conversation to the arts, if that's okay.
I'm happy to go wherever you like.
Because, Martin, you know, there's... We all know that... Well, we know, and it's been blatantly obvious to us, that one sector that... Look, so many sectors are taking a hit, a big hit, but it's the arts sector, you know, that has been such a part of Victoria's culture and our economic growth and, you know, our, dare I say, our mental well-being, such as it is. And that sector has been impacted really, really hard. You know, we've seen, you know, people, we've seen organisations, theatres, basically shut down. And that in so many cases, they don't qualify for JobKeeper, let alone job seeker, and they're doing it really, really tough. And we, as a community, we need to support these people wherever we can. But as a government, I'm interested in what the government is doing in this space with regard to the arts sector in Victoria.
Thanks, Macca. You're spot on. The cultural and creative communities were the earliest and the hardest hit, and from a report that I saw from Deloitte Access Economics this week, the current figure is over 60% of organisations, big, small and individual, have ceased to operate. And the expectation is, because of the precarious nature of how work is organised and work is forecasted, there's an expectation that it will take until 2026
Jeez.
To get back to previous levels, and that's at the national level. Here in Victoria, we reacted relatively quickly, and we're just this week with the announcement of the new Rising Melbourne Festival to take place in about this time next year, the new Winter Cultural Festival, which had a $2 million grant program to now develop new work from Victorian creators for that festival. That $2 million has taken us to $51 million worth of investment since the pandemic began in our direct support for creative communities, individuals, organisations. And that places us, I'm pleased to say, at the forefront of any responses at either a national or state level around the country. But equally, it's got to be seen as a down payment in stabilisation, survival, and then recovery of the sector. And before the boom came down on COVID-19, we were well down the path of our second creative state consultation strategy, which had at its heart a new policy outcome that would have focused on Indigenous, diverse communities and small, medium, independent organisations to drive that cultural pipeline of creativity that underpins all the things you talked about, Macca. This has set us back, undoubtedly, but this sector is so important to our well-being, our sense of community and collective solidarity, and economically, that it is a sector that we have to support, gather around, and advocate on behalf. And I have been a little bit disappointed so far in the Commonwealth's response, and seeing now, for instance, the capacity of the JobKeeper program to perhaps be a little bit more generous. The creative communities are the original gig economy people, and it's almost as if the original JobKeeper was designed to exclude them. This is now an opportunity
to include. You're not going to get any disagreement from us on that at all, Martin. And Macca has a very strong view about that.
I just think there's now an opportunity as private support dries up. Not now for government to step forward and support these critical elements of what holds communities together, let alone brings them back economically.
Well, especially when the money's already there, of course.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, yes, we're all going into deficit, Yes, we're all going to have to work hard to address that in the long term, but we've got to get to the long term, and we've got to be in a position where our communities stand together across the political divide, and government leads the funding and the delivery of holding our community together and funding the social, economic and cultural comeback.
And look, Martin, you know, I want to place on record the government and, you know, and through yourself, Joy has received a lot of support during this time. A number of new initiatives we've launched to, you know, keep our community informed and engaged, and that's only been possible through the support of the government, and I want to recognise that. It's made a real difference, and, you know, there's some new initiatives coming in that area that Ange and myself and others will talk about over the coming weeks. But I want to place that on record. And I know other organisations, other arts organisations, have also received support, and that has enabled them in a number of ways to at least keep their head above water or continue to function in some form. So,
including the new Pride Centre, Macca, which will be our new home.
Exactly. And you know, the reality is, you know, we see there's an article this morning about the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra and some of the challenges. Well, I'm not going to be unkind to them because I don't know all the facts. But I think there's some challenges there, and that's a hugely important organisation to Victoria and to Australia. But there are just, there are many, many small, you know, groups, you know, artist groups, you know, and individual artists that need support. So I'm glad to see the government's doing that. And I know the City of Melbourne is also working really, really hard in this area, and full points to Sally Capp and Aaron Woods and other members of council there. Do you see, Martin, you know, moving forward, what is going to be the best way for government and communities to sustain and support these organisations? It's not just about money, it's about actually giving opportunities, isn't it, for these organisations and these artists to present their work?
Well, the truth is, Macca, that I suspect a number of them will probably just fold.
Yeah. What are your thoughts, Martin?
You're both right. The first thing we've got to do is sustain them through the worst of the crisis. And I fear that a few won't. That's why we're putting our $16 million crisis response fund from about a month ago to make sure that about 80 small, medium, independent organisations right across the state could continue to pay the bills whilst they planned for the recovery. The most important thing that we can all do is, when the opportunity arises, to continue that level of support for organisations to subscribe, to attend when it is safe to do so in the appropriate way. Those organisations are already big, small and independent and in between, are all looking to how can they, in a COVID-safe way, start to re-engage with their audiences, with their creatives, in a way that counts. I'll just use the Rising Festival that was launched during the week. This is an amalgamation of how we bring together the previous White Nights events and the organisation once known as the Melbourne International Arts Festival. They have a particular focus around Melbourne and Victoria as a place that is particularly focused on our stories, whether they be Indigenous, whether they be diverse communities, whether they be the kind of stories that we know need expression in a confident, forward-looking way. And what we're trying to do is, through their $2 million fund, go out to creatives and say, develop your work, develop your ideas. This is the period in which we can both get ready for that big comeback, but we've got to sustain the creatives, we've got to sustain the organisations that build that. So my message to everyone out there is, the opportunity will be coming around very soon where you can support people directly, organisations directly, in a different way, in a COVID-safe way, whether it be online platform, attending in an appropriate manner and looking for opportunities to engage as audience and supporters that will drive this really important part of our cultural landscape to a different and, I hope, better future.
Martin, that was fantastic. Thank you for that. Just moving right along, though, what about the queer communities?
Yes.
I did notice during the week that not only was there an announcement around some of the arts initiatives like Macca talked about and a grant coming towards this organisation, Joy 94.9, but also I did notice that you put out some extended grants for
yes.
the Hay program. Tell us a bit about that. What are you hoping to achieve through that program?
So we announced over $500,000 worth of support for the Hay program, healthy young programs directed to LGBTIQ organisations and their allies right around the state.
That's a whole lot more than when I was involved with the Hay program.
Yeah, well, well, there you go.
Takes a crisis to get money to the community, does it?
Well, I'd like to think that since we're elected, we've been building the capacity of these organisations, and they keep coming forward with really significant proposals. And the good thing about these 8 programs that we funded this week is the majority of them are in the region.
Because the
community support for LGBTIQ, particularly young people, needs to be targeted at the areas of greatest need. So whether it's the diversity program that Unite deliver in Shepparton, or whether it's the Wodonga Gateway Health program with their really significant support that they provide for transgender and gender questioning young people in that community, whether it's the work in partnership with the Latrobe Community Health in Morwell, in Gippsland, work done in Ballarat with gender diverse and same-sex attracted young people in that community, which has gone through its own particular trauma at the same time as the COVID emergency with the issues associated with Cardinal Pell's release. All of these things amplify together, and it's these communities that really need our targeted and increased support, and I'm quite proud that $500,000 plus has been going out the door to help these great community-led projects to not just survive, but to build better connections.
That's a great issue. That's fantastic.
Particularly for young, gender, and diverse young people.
Now, I've actually been keeping a bit of account, Martin. Since elected, Victorian government has allocated in excess of $80 million to LGBTIQ issues, organisations, challenges and resources.
Jeez, $80 million?
More than $80 million. That's recognition that we are part of the Victorian community and you know, that we are getting the resources that we need. Personally, a lot of people don't know that, but that's the amount of money. Is that sound about right, Martin, or am I miscounting?
You might be counting through the equality portfolio, which we established, and I'm really pleased has at least been followed by one other jurisdiction in the ACT, and that's important. But the key part of the portfolio is to drive the recognition through the rest of government of dedicated, organised programs. So that doesn't take into account the fact that we've now rolled safe schools out to the entire state. It doesn't take into account the work that the Children's Hospital has done in the gender dysphoria work, that Monash is doing in the adult gender dysphoria work. By the time you add the whole of government efforts up, it is now in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
I mean, I've lowballed you. Have I lowballed you, Martin?
You have.
Hang on, I could work in Federal Treasury.
Now, Macca, behave.
You accurately described the equality portfolio, but the key investment in that portfolio is the capacity building that opens in October. That will be the organising and community building, leadership development, celebratory place that will allow the LGBTIQ community to be in charge of their own destiny. And that will be a symbol that Out Loud and Proud is one thing, but Out Loud and Proud and organised and strong is another level altogether.
As Neville Wran once said, you've got the commitment, but follow the money. And, look, we've run out of time, Martin.
But really good to have this conversation.
Yeah.
Great to hear about some of the investments, but also, you know, unpacking some of the issues and what they mean for our communities.
And I hope, you know, you're staying well, Martin, and you know, I know you always have a really positive outlook on it. I'm sure that in your household there's a new awareness of having dinner together that didn't always happen in the past because of your commitment. So I hope everyone's enjoying that and you're all behaving yourself.
Yeah, well, they wonder who this strange bloke at dinner time is over the last time.
Well, there is rumours that your dog bit you last time you came home.
That was Martin Foley, Minister for Equality, Mental Health and the Arts and the Member for Elwood Park. Thank you very much for the conversation this morning.
Saturday Magazine is proudly sponsored by Velocity Rewards, the loyalty program of Virgin Australia.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.